From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Eben Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in late March, just about 4 months ago on this program, when astrophysicist Adam Frank made a prediction of sorts. He told us that the pandemic was going to reshape how Americans feel about climate change and climate action. Adam thought that we were quickly learning how much of an impact we can make in a short amount of time. And so if we didn't want to make the world go back to how it was before the pandemic, we would decide to make permanent changes. We'd consider energy usage, travel, transportation, time spent in nature, and more. And then pandemic fatigue seemed to set in. Since the beginning of June, there's been a wave of reports from psychologists and sociologists about the draining nature of this global crisis. The refrain we now often hear is that many people can't wait to get the world back to normal, quote, or pre-pandemic times. What is normal, though? And how much of that normal should return when this pandemic subsides? The Nature Conservancy set out to find some of the answers. They wanted to know what New Yorkers in particular want to see change or not. And the answers are pretty illuminating. And so I've asked the chapter director of the Nature Conservancy of New York, Central and Western New York, to come on in and, well, not in. I'd like to see you in person, Jim Howe. You're still on the phone. One of these days I'll see you in person. But he's been kind enough with his time, and Jim Howe is back with us. How are you?
I'm great, Evan. Thanks for having us on the show today. And yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, and I think some reasons to be hopeful, too.
Well, I like that. So this is sort of a hopeful day. We got good vaccine news today. We're not going to overstate it, listeners. We don't do that on this program because we know it's a long, long road. But pretty good vaccine news so far in one of the recent trials. That's good. The Atlantic Monthly has some pretty good news about all those scary antibody stories we saw last week, that antibodies subside real quickly. Turns out not really, and you want to read what Derek Thompson wrote in The Atlantic today. That's hopeful. Jim Howe's here with some hopeful ideas on it. But before we get into the meat of that, why don't you give me a sense for what the Nature Conservancy wanted to accomplish with this survey? What was the overarching goal here, Jim?
Yeah, thanks, Evan. So first of all, let me just make sure your listeners know who we are. The Nature Conservancy, we're a nonprofit, global nonprofit, working in every state. We have a very healthy chapter here in New York State. And, you know, as we looked at the pandemic and COVID, we really wanted to understand, okay, how have public attitudes towards environmental initiatives, have they changed? How are they being shaped by the pandemic here in New York? So we also wanted to test, you know, is climate change still relevant to people? Are people still concerned about climate change in a world where, you know, you can't even exit your home some days? So we are really heartened by some of this news here. We learned that people care deeply about nature. They're New Yorkers love their environment. They love clean water, clean air, healthy landscapes, healthy forests and farms. They value all these things. And they don't simply want to press reset. They don't just want to go back to the way things were. They really see this as an opportunity, the pandemic and our recovery from it. They see it as an opportunity to work toward a different and a better future.
Now, there is a part of me over the last 4 months that's had to resist hardening into a cynic because, you know, I'm usually wrong about everything, and the hopeful nature that I have sometimes gets challenged. It's been a hard 4 to 5 months here. So if there is that cynic on my shoulder, he says, well, look, if you ask people, do you care about nature? Do you care about the environment? Do you want to? Most people are going to say yes. So I want to be, you know, we're going to kind of move specifically through what you, as much as you can reveal, what you were asking and what it did reveal. Because I think in general, Jim, if you ask people, do you care about nature? Do you want to see it protected? People will say yes, right? I mean, it takes something pretty ghoulish to say no.
Well, that is true. That is very true. But I think, you know, what we talked about here was not just do you care about nature. Do you want to invest in it? Do you want your public leadership, the governor, the Cuomo administration, your local communities, do you want them to invest in a healthy environment? And the answer is a resounding yes. So it is more than that. It is, they really want to see investment, and they see investment in nature as an opportunity to recover from the pandemic and to get things, do things right, to build a better future for ourselves.
Well, I do think that this pandemic has, especially this summer, has pushed so many of us not only outdoors, but outdoors more often than we typically would be, and maybe outdoors in different ways, because, you know, assuming we're following the guidelines, we're not in large clusters of people. So we're not going to festivals. We're not going to concerts. we may be outdoors in nature more. That has been true for me and my boy and for, you know, a small, tight circle around me. I think it's true for a lot of the people I know. What has your surveying indicated about what New Yorkers, how they feel about access to nature? And the reason I ask that is, you know, you look around and there are wonderful parks and public spaces here. They don't always, and then there's beautiful space that's private. And there's always sort of this push-pull on access to space, who gets to enjoy it, who can have access to it. Did you find anything there?
Yeah, these are really important questions. And let me give you a sense, too, of who did our survey for us. We commissioned a polling firm out of California who talked to almost 700 voters in New York State. And we got some really important numbers here. This was done in early June, so really before the second wave of the pandemic hit. And this, you know, this is a snapshot in time. We realize that, but we still think that it's very relevant. So on the access to nature issue, that's really important to New Yorkers. 90% of the voters that responded that they support making parks and open space and natural areas more accessible to New Yorkers, and that's all across the state. There's also the issue of access and equity too, in access is also important to people. We had 86% support for the idea that we should have more funding invested in low-income communities and communities of color, which don't have the same access to these resources as other parts of the state too do. So, I mean, these are really important numbers, I think. And then another piece of information that we got too is that more than 4/5 of New Yorkers think that it's important to have a modern park or green space, a safe place, within a 10-minute walk or drive from where they live. So, yes, more nature, more access to nature, but I think there's recognition that right now that that's not even, that there are some people that have more access than others, and that because it's important from a public health perspective to get out into nature. I mean, there's lots of evidence, Evan, that you know, if you can see nature from your hospital room window, you recover faster. Kids that are in a school room, they can see nature when they're taking a test. They do better, whether it's just seeing trees or a lawn. And when we get out and hike in a forest on a trail, you know, our blood pressure drops. We calm down. There are benefits to nature, major human health benefits and mental health benefits for being out in nature. And our survey is showing that people really recognize that they want to be out in nature more, and that those benefits aren't distributed equally across the state.
Tomorrow on this program, we're going to welcome New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, all about divesting from fossil fuels. And that's a phrase or an idea that is kind of nebulous, I think, to most people. Like, what does that really mean tangibly? But he has staked out a real commitment to doing so in a recent op-ed, and we've invited him along with local youth climate leaders who've been pushing for it, and he's going to come on the program tomorrow, and he's going to get specific about it. And as we go later throughout this program with Jim Howe from the Nature Conservancy, we're going to talk about policy ideas that are maybe within reach that, you know, we might actually see happen. Listeners, I'd also love to hear from you. Are you spending more time outdoors during this pandemic, and has it changed you at all? Has it changed the way you viewed how you schedule your time, what you value, and do you think it will sort of get pulled back to a pre-pandemic state, or do you think some of these changes might be permanent? It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994, or email us, connections@WXXI.org. Has this changed you and your habits? Are you outside more? The survey indicates, again, I don't know how much you can get specific on the granular stuff, Jim, but the survey does indicate that people are saying in pretty significant numbers that not only are they spending more time outside, but they're kind of having that moment where they go, I want to do this, whether there's a vaccine, post-pandemic, I want to do more of this, right?
Yeah, no question. And, you know, more than a third of the people that responded to our survey said that they wanted to spend more time outside after the pandemic. And that, unfortunately, there are people who haven't been able to get outside as much, too, in the pandemic, particularly lower income New Yorkers, we found, urban residents, people of color. And that is a concern of the Nature Conservancies. You know, we are asking ourselves, increasingly reflecting on that question, how can we do better and making sure that our preserves, and, you know, we own 160,000 acres of conservation lands across the state, both preserves and conservation easements. And we are looking at the distribution of those. We're thinking about where can we be investing more in preserves that are more accessible for people. We're also, Evan, we're thinking about how we can get people to our preserves that may not have transportation options too. So we're doing a really interesting partnership in Westchester County, where our stewardship team is actually providing transportation for people from New York City who are coming up now. We're doing guided hikes, providing bus transportation, and we're getting incredible turnouts for that. We're partnering with a group called Latino Outdoors. And those are the things that we're reflecting on. How can we do better at this? I mean, we're relatively new to this. I don't want to pretend that this is something that we've been doing for a while, but we do think this is important, and it's been a change in our work over the last few years, definitely.
Well, let me get our first phone call. This is Bill in Rochester on the line. Go ahead, Bill.
How are you doing, Evan?
Good.
My question is, I get what Nature Conservancy wants to do or trying to do, but up in Jefferson County in Henderson, New York, there's a place called Black Pond, and they put in this beautiful boardwalk and gave access to the public, but it's just turned into a big party spot where all the kids come, leave their trash, go to the bathroom, and they've ruined this beach, which is supposed to be for the birds and all that kind of thing. So I guess, how do we get people to nature, but yet not destroy it?
That's an interesting question. Jim Howe, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I thank you, Bill. I know this area well. So this is an area called Black Pond Wildlife Management Area. It's at the eastern shore of Lake Ontario. It's actually owned by the state of New York. The Nature Conservancy, however, owns about a mile of shoreline just to the north of this state protected area. And the state, about, I would say, Bill, maybe 15 years or so ago, maybe longer, put in a boardwalk to allow people to access the beach on their state lands. And that, you're right, that unfortunately has resulted in some, I would say, you know, some overuse of that area. And we're finding that, you know, you have to find that balance between promoting access and setting aside areas that are fragile. And if you do promote access too, you have to make sure that access is monitored. And that's one of the things we've been doing on the eastern shore of Lake Ontario is we've got what we call our Dune Steward Program, where people, we hire mostly college students who are actually out on the beach every day, making sure that people who are using the beach are using it respectfully. But these are hard issues, because unless you're there all the time, it's really hard sometimes to prevent access that may not be appropriate. But, you know, again, it's a balance, because you don't build that next generation of conservationists, of people who care about nature, without giving them access opportunities to get there. So you have to find the right places where you can provide that. You have to monitor it when you do, and you have to make sure you're setting aside areas that are fragile. So that's a great question, Bill. I'd be happy to talk to you more about that offline too.
Bill, what do you want to see done about it?
I had a place there since I was born, and I've seen it just get destroyed, and it's bothersome. And everything was fine before they made access and promoted it. Instead, the opposite happened. And they have all these signs, you know, don't walk on the dunes, you know, don't hurt the bird life and all this. Well, meanwhile, the high water has destroyed everything. You know, people talk both ways. They say they want, you know, to save, you know, the wildlife and this and that. And then they let the lake rise and ruin it anyway. So, you know, I don't know. It depends on who you're talking to. I don't know. You have to see the area. It's pretty destroyed now.
Well, Bill, good luck to you. Thanks for the phone call. And, you know, Jim, to that point, I was standing way out, you know, near the lighthouse, the pier at Shalott the other day, and just an unbelievable sunset. And the amount of people out there was just, it was fabulous. It was just wonderful to see so much of Rochester, appropriately distanced, enjoying the air and enjoying that sunset. Yeah, and occasionally you walk by, you know, someone for some reason threw out a paper plate. They didn't feel like throwing it. You know, and yeah, there's that part of you that goes like, what? Why? Why? But there has to be a balance knowing, you know, you're never going to have a perfect scenario, but you do, to Bill's point, want to find a way to balance. I would assume, based on your survey, Jim, most people do support public access as much as possible to these beautiful and important spaces. And there's probably a little bit of a balance and a push-pull, especially as you open up more space. Is that fair?
Totally. You know, New Yorkers love wildlife, too. I mean, this is not just about creating softball fields and every public space that we own. It's about habitat, too. And we have to keep that front and center. But, you know, this is that push-pull that you said, Evan. I mean, look at the National Park Service. I mean, their mission is to protect these jewels for us, but also to provide access to them. And I think we all of us in the business of protecting natural lands, I mean, we have to find that same balance, too. And, you know, I just want to respond to one thing Bill said, too, about water levels. I mean, nobody advocated for higher water levels on Lake Ontario. They just happened because of, you know, we're in this incredible cyclical pattern right now of high precipitation. Could be climate influenced. I don't know. But, you know, no one is out there saying, oh, we need higher water levels on Lake Ontario. It's happening in all the Great Lakes right now. That's a whole separate conversation, I know. I just wanted to address that, though.
Yeah, I told my 8-year-old recently, I said, you know, there was a time before you were born when sometimes it would just rain. You know, it wasn't two weeks of 95-degree drought and then rains like the end of the world and then two more weeks of drought and then rain. Sometimes it would just rain. Could you believe it? And he was like, wow. No, I mean, I'm being sort of facetious here. And I tried to tell him I am not a climatologist and I'm not going to connect every weather event to rain. But there does seem to be an extreme edge to weather. And we do know that there is some connection to climate there, particularly in precipitation events. So, So Bill, good luck to you. And thank you for the phone call. And I feel empathy for you. I mean, nobody wants to see places ruined, but we want to see, and the survey indicates more people want access. As we talked to Jim Howe from the Nature Conservancy about a survey they did, some research into what the public and what New Yorkers want, especially when the pandemic ends. What do we want life to be? And if we don't want it to go exactly back to what it was before, what do we want for ourselves and for our planet? And, you know, before we kind of dig back into policy, let me just ask you a little bit if there are partisan differences. I mean, do you have a way of knowing the people you're talking to and whether their reactions to your questions are about how they want life to be or what policies they supported? Have you been able to discern any partisan differences?
Yeah, I mean, of course there are. I mean, people from different parties often have different values, and I think these are reflected in some of the responses that we got. But I would say overall, you know, there really is strong support from all New Yorkers for protecting our lands and waters and for using the pandemic as an opportunity to build a better future. I think overall that is not something that is a partisan issue at all. And clean water, clean air, sustainability, those things are important to everybody. If you think about the term conservative, Evan, too, the conservation is the root of that. And sustainability and the conservative causes often are very much aligned. But, you know, we did see there's definitely intensity, more intensity for some positions than others based on how people identify themselves, which party they identify with. But I don't want that to detract from the fact that overall there's broad support for these issues in the state of New York.
Sure. And I take the point that, you know, when Jim says people from different political parties tend to have different values, that's not a knock on different values from different parties. And I hope that we can try to be generous with one another, even in an election year, that people from different political parties have different values, but that doesn't all mean that they are, you know, sort of malicious values. For example, conservatives value the, you know, individual spirit and drive and individual freedoms and the rights of individuals to achieve. And then if you accumulate wealth, you accumulate wealth. If you accumulate land and space, that's what you do. Progressives tend to think a little bit more collectively and community-minded and maybe a little bit more disposed to thinking that it's important to keep space open. You can understand the root of both of those viewpoints, but I think it sounds to me like, Jim, what you're trying to do is find where there's a commonality across political boundaries of what people want. Fair?
Yeah, and I would say clean air, clean water, a sustainable future. Those are bridge issues. They are, and I think everyone gets behind them. Everyone understands them. You know, and whether you're someone who owns a home on a beautiful on waterfront that loves to swim and boat in your lake, or whether you're someone who just turns on the tap and really appreciates that great clean water from one of our Finger Lakes that comes out of your tap, I think, yeah, we share a common bond here. And then the political divide, their partisan divides are really not as strong on the environment as they are on other issues.
Talking to Jim Howe from the Nature Conservancy, if you want to engage with the program as we talk about how your habits and appreciation of nature, thoughts on the future of our world post-pandemic might look, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Part of what we are talking about is whether the last 4 months have changed you at all, or if your habits have changed, and if you want that change to stay. And I would think that for the more than one-third of people who responded to your survey, Jim, who said, yes, they're spending more time outside and they want to continue that post-pandemic, I'm going to try to make a case for something, and I want to know if you agree. I think when you ask people generally, if you care about climate change, if you care about the future of the planet, most people will say yes. But people are more invested if they feel more connected to nature. They feel more connected to their landscape in various ways and could see the beauty, but also could see the harm. So the more time we're spending outside, the more we're likely to be a little bit more tangibly connected to a cause, as opposed to saying in a survey, oh, yeah, I care about that, but you're spending most of the time in an office or indoors and you're not really outside. So maybe one of the values that we take forward out of this pandemic is if we're more connected to nature, then we've got a bit more of a, you know, a real connection to the work that has to be done in the future.
Yeah, I think that's true on any issue. If you can have a personal, if you're personally invested in it somehow, I think you feel it more, and you have a desire to understand it more too. And so much, I think most of the issues that we face right now are policy issues. The people that are most emotional about it often have the loudest voices. But that's not often the majority, yet they're often able to influence where things go. So that's one of the reasons why we do think it's important to have more access to nature. Again, finding that balance is that getting people more invested, more connected to the places they live about, understanding where their drinking water comes from. And these are really important issues. Most Americans do not know where their drinking water comes from. If you ask them, they will say, oh, well, it comes from the tap. I haven't even thought about that. And that's something we need to think.
I'm laughing at myself, too, by the way. I'm laughing at myself, too, on that. Yeah.
Where do you live, Evan?
I live in Charlotte.
What community? Charlotte. Okay. So, yeah, your water is probably coming from Lake Ontario. But if you lived in the city of Rochester, closer to Center City, you'd be getting Hemlock and Canadize Lake water.
I would have guessed I was getting Canadize. But
I think, you know, up closer to the lakeshore,
Ontario.
I think you're getting water from Lake Ontario, yeah, which is treated just not far from you at the Shoreham plant, just maybe a mile or so to the west of Charlotte.
See? That's such a great lesson. I had no idea, though. I would have had to guess. You're right.
Yeah. You know, and we asked this question. This is a great example of back to Bill's point. You know, when do you promote access? When do you set aside something just for habitat? And those of you who listeners who've been down to our Robb's Trail Preserve, which is at Hemlock Lake and Canadize Lake, what we were just talking about, that's a trail that we built, the Nature Conservancy built in partnership with the state of New York and the city of Rochester to provide access to the lakeshore on Hemlock, access that really was difficult to get to. And so we thought long and hard about whether this was the right decision. And we thought, you know, this is an area that is 7,000 acres. There's very few points where you can access the lake shore other than the boat launches. So we decided to build the trail. It's a very popular trail now. By all accounts, you know, this is something that is not having the trail is not having an impact on the natural system or the wildlife of the Hemlock and Canadize watershed. So we feel that's a victory there, getting people out into nature. And when you're out there, if you read our signs, we talk about where does your drinking water come from? comes from right here. You know, back in the 1870s is when the city of Rochester made the investment here. So, you know, this is a 150-year-old water system that's still working exactly as it did then. So, the access issues are great, but you're right that we need to make sure people are educated about issues and emotionally invested in these issues too. That's when I think we will see the changes that I believe a lot of New Yorkers want based on this poll response.
Back to the phones we go. Sarah in Rochester next. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment and a question related to that. So I'm curious if you have read the most recent reports coming out of the climate emergency movement of young people, Sunrise and others that are involved with, and Greta Thunberg recently launched this campaign on behalf of the whole coalition around facing the climate emergency. The issue that I'm struggling with right now is the idea that it has to be based on public opinion, whether we move forward when there are natural laws and limits that we're already seeing the impacts of, including this pandemic, which is a direct result of the loss of habitat and the exposure to zoological or zoonotic viruses, which will actually increase. So we're also hearing about these massive wildfires and brush fires all over the world, flooding from just high tides being even much more severe and increasing in their regularity. We haven't hit hurricane season yet, but I'm guessing it's probably going to be pretty brutal. But in other parts of the world, they have had massive flooding and massive destruction from natural disasters resulting directly from climate disruption. So my question is, what position does the Conservancy have on ensuring that folks have the information in order to be more thoughtful about what's actually happening and what the natural boundaries are of our participation in certain kinds of activity, including industrial and also consumer and participating in the world the way that we're used to?
Yeah, very insightful question and observation, Sarah. Thank you. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And I do want to spend some time talking about the findings and the answers we got around climate here. We haven't covered that yet, and we will. Before I do that, I do want to just talk about the comments you made about, you know, could the coronavirus be caused by, you know, loss of habitat? And I think the answers to that we're seeing are, yes, that intrusion into tropical forests by roads and fragmentation is allowing people to encounter wildlife that are sometimes the natural reservoirs of viruses like this. And then when those wildlife are captured and brought to markets, so-called wet markets, and sold, that's when they interact with other animals and interact with people. And there is an increasing body of evidence that shows that, you know, protecting these large intact tropical forest habitats is probably one of the most important things we can do right now to prevent future outbreaks of viruses. So I think that's a great comment you made, Sarah. Thank you. So yeah, on the climate front, we did have some really interesting findings here. I think first of all, is that a majority of New Yorkers, 70%, believe that our recovery from the COVID pandemic is really an opportunity to take on a challenge as big as climate change, that we can't think of these separately. We can't isolate them and think, oh, let's do the recovery, and then we'll figure out how to resolve climate, that they are one and the same. We can wed them together. The other thing that I think is really interesting is here is that by a 2-to-1 margin, more people have confidence now in science than before the pandemic. So when we ask people, how do you feel about science? Do you feel that we should be listening to our scientists? Yes, an increasing margin of New Yorkers believe that to be true, which is very heartening to me as someone who works with science all the time. I'm not a scientist myself, but I do feel it's helping to shape the Nature Conservancy's work.
I thought of everything I've seen so far from this survey. That might have been, and there's a lot of, you're right, there's a lot of optimistic stuff there about what people want and what people are willing to do and how people see the world changing. But there's been an increase by a 2-to-1 margin in trust in science during the pandemic, an increase.
Correct. Yeah, they have more trust in science now than they did before the pandemic. Exactly. And then some other information here too, is 7 in 10 New Yorkers believe that climate change is caused by human activity. That compares with about 62% nationwide. And then the other number that I thought was interesting is that more and more people are saying that they believe that climate change is causing them, quote, a moderate amount or more of personal harm. And that's an increase over the last year. That's 56% of New Yorkers believe that climate change has harmed them somewhat personally, compared to 43% nationally. So back to the comments earlier about how do we get people personally invested? That's when real change happens. I think when people start to see, oh, climate is impacting me, whether it's my property is flooded, or my heating bills or my cooling bills are much more, or I have to buy another air conditioner, or my crops have failed. That's when we start to see real change, in my opinion.
I just want to kind of highlight that before I grab another phone call. Once again, what Jim just said, the survey from the Nature Conservancy finds that New Yorkers, more than the average across the country, believe that climate change is personally impacting them or personally harming them. 56%, at least a moderate amount. And you said the national average is 43%. Is that right?
43%. That's correct.
Yeah. And that number in this state is going up pretty significantly. That is, to me, a remarkable number. More than half. People are now connecting it to their lives. Because, Jim, when we've talked for so long about how hard climate action is going to be to get people to buy in on, one of the reasons is it's the idea, well, I don't live on a coast, or, you know, I don't live in an extreme weather place. So if we live in sort of a milquetoast climate like we kind of are, I know we get a lot of snow in the winter, I get it. But for people to now be connecting it, more than half of New Yorkers connecting it, that to me says the door is really open for policy, because people don't feel it's so abstract anymore.
Right, right. 6 days in a row of 90-plus heat last 2 weeks ago, that's very unusual for New York. Harmful algal blooms in our Finger Lakes. Skinny Atlas Lake, one of the cleanest Finger Lakes, the cleanest Finger Lake, I think, by most people's by consensus, now seeing harmful algal blooms. I mean, something is changing, and people are believing that it's climate related, and they're seeing that this personally have an impact on their lives and their livelihoods.
We're talking to Jim.
Mother,
let's do this, Jim. Since I'm late for a break, I want to talk about what you found about what New Yorkers want regarding jobs, regarding investing in nature. We've already kind of talked about access, but for listeners that you want to put numbers on, I mean, it's a massive, massive, I mean, it's 90% or more of New Yorkers, of voters, they support making parks and open space and natural areas more accessible all over the state. So keep the parks we have, expand, make it more accessible, because people are connecting to nature during this pandemic. So we're going to talk about what they found regarding investing in nature and jobs. Rick and Livonia will grab your phone call, and we've got other feedback to share with listeners as we talk with the chapter director of the Nature Conservancy, Jim Howe, on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. What does it mean when we talk about divest from fossil fuels? Well, Comptroller Tom DiNapoli of New York State joins us on the program Tuesday. Climate activists are celebrating a recent decision made by the comptroller. He wrote an op-ed in the Times Union talking about new decisions to divest from fossil fuels. He will explain why and what it means for the future. Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the phone next is Rick in Livonia. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, hi, Evan. Thanks a lot for what you're doing. It's very good stuff you're talking about. Race, environment, climate change, police, violence, guns, and all that. I wonder if you could explore a more basic issue, the disruption to our basic moral values. There's a selfish or generous mode that we go through, and more we're becoming selfish. So I just have some discussion about that with folks.
Yeah, so Rick, that is a very interesting idea. I can tell you I've been reading a lot about that, but I'd love for you to define what for me, because selfishness and generosity can be applied in a lot of different directions. Where are you thinking about it?
Well, I'm thinking about it when I was a youngster, which was 70-some years ago. My mother, occasionally, as I was leaving for school, she would shout out to me, "See you tonight," and then she would follow up with, "Be generous or be selfish. You decide today." And it had a tremendous impact on me. She put me in a position where I had to decide what I was going to do that day. And I think we've lost sight of some of that. We in our rush to survive, in our rush to be better than everything else, to have the best of everything, raising the bar, always wanting more for our children, we've lost sight of some basic moral grounding. And I wish we could get some of that back.
Rick, that's a beautiful sentiment. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
And
thanks for what you're doing, Evan. Bye.
Thank you. So, and Rick, I'm just going to hoist that straight from, I'm gonna steal that, I should say, right from your mother, and I'm going to apply that to my boy.
That's good stuff.
Be selfish or be generous today. You decide. I really like that. But I will. Let me tell you, Rick, a little bit about where I've been thinking about that. I've been thinking about generosity when it comes to thinking about people who disagree with us. And I am not saying that the urgency of this moment in regards to a lot of different things is not deserved or, frankly, is not vital to the path that we're choosing to try to build a better and more equitable society. So the urgency I get, at times the anger I get, I just hope that we can see, be generous enough with one another to think that people who hold different beliefs don't hold them maliciously. They don't hold them just because they want to hurt people. I think most people hold beliefs sincerely and intellectually honestly. What I mean by that is they've arrived at these conclusions because they think that that is the most logical or the best way to view things. And a generosity of spirit with argument and with discourse indicates that you can think someone's wrong and you can think they're wrong and their wrongness hurts people. But trying to actually engage with why they arrived there or how they got there is a better way than simply telling them how awful they are. And I don't see a lot of bridges built with insults. We see a lot more bridges being built when there's patience and time to deconstruct. Now, if that sounds a little idealistic, well, I said earlier this hour, I'm guarding against cynicism. So, Jim Howe, that's the idealist in me. but I love the generosity of spirit that he's talking about there. I love that.
Me too. Me too. We're not going to solve any of these problems if we just talk to people that share the same views as we do.
Yeah.
Right? We have to reach across the aisle, talk to people that are different from us. That's so important. We don't do enough of that anymore because I think we like to confine ourselves to the echo chambers that validate what we think already. So that's really important observation from you and from Rick too.
Well, but Jim, everything I think is right.
Well, you're right, of course. I wasn't referring to you.
Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that. Is there anything in your survey, by the way, and this is not to say that, you know, whatever belief you may hold or the values of the Nature Conservancy are, they must be applied to everyone. But was there anything that you found in this survey of New Yorkers that disappointed you or that you thought might be more in one direction and it wasn't?
I was a little surprised how when we asked people about access to nature, I was surprised and dismayed, too, that people of color, people from lower income communities in New York, have not been able to get outdoors as much as others. And that, again, that just kind of underscored to me that we need to do a better job in New York of ensuring that there is equitable access to nature throughout our state. As I mentioned, we're thinking hard about that at the Nature Conservancy, how we can have a stronger voice there and take some more action in that and along those lines. So that was something that I saw as a surprise. The other thing I would say that surprised me, or maybe not surprised, but that I was heartened by, that I kind of took notice of, is that people really are thinking that we should be looking at our cities differently. And I know that the pandemic in some cities, people they've closed streets to allow restaurants to have more outdoor dining. Mm-hmm. And, that really popped for us. What was the number here? 75% of people that responded to this said they would be okay to limit vehicle traffic on some city streets to allow for more exercise, outdoor dining, or other outdoor activities. I think our cities sometimes have been designed too much for cars. I think that speaks to that cities are for city streets are for people too. They're not just for cars. You know, I love the movie Cars. I'm sure you've watched that with your son. Great movie. But sometimes you drive down a suburban street and all you see are these big garages. You don't see the house, and the garage is centerpiece. And you think, oh, cars live here. People don't live here. Cars live here. I think we should try to twist that around and have cities that are friendly to people as much as they are to vehicles. And I know we need to drive our vehicles to access different places. I understand that, but I think we can find a better balance there between creating more outdoor spaces for dining in many of our cities.
So this is where. I love that one. I'll read that number again for listeners to see it. Because I imagine a lot of people agree, but I'm sure some don't. That's fine. This is a place where the host of this program is more than happy to share how I feel, my personal bias. I had somebody the other day, by the way, accuse me on Twitter of trying to act like I'm the only neutral journalist. I've never said there. Neutrality doesn't really exist. I mean, I guess in certain scenarios it can, but there is no objective journalism. In the way that, because what that implies is journalists might figure out the one truth, but they can be, you know, neutral in the deployment of their own bias. And that's just not, you know, the way human beings work. I'm a human being. I understand that I've got biases, and I'm trying to be self-aware of that. I think the key is not trying to be an objective journalist, which doesn't really exist. The key is to ask yourself, what are your biases? And what would your work look like if you were beholden only to your biases, or if you were self-aware of them and tried to make sure that they didn't dominate your work? And I'm sure some days right. I do pretty well, some days not so much. But here's a bias. Here's a bias. I'll just put it right out there. I love that answer. 75% of your respondents said, yes, limit vehicle traffic on some city streets. I'm not saying abolish the car. But limit traffic, shut them down, let people play, exercise, dine outside. Can you imagine what city streets would look like if we always talk Park Avenue. That's fine. It's an easy one to think of. But let's just say Park Avenue, that the whole street there were playgrounds in the middle of the street. I'm talking post-pandemic, too. Playgrounds in the middle of the street, outdoor exercise equipment, swing sets, diners and restaurants could put tables out in the middle of streets, bicycle traffic, but no cars, pedestrian, space, maybe more green. How cool that would be. And frankly, when you go to, the WXXI Travel Club, went to Spain, I saw that everywhere, Jim. And I'm going, this is phenomenal.
Nice.
Old European cities, yeah. They're still doing that.
Oh, yeah. Those cities were designed pre-car, and you can see how much more livable they are. I think there is room to do this too, not just in New York City. There's room to do it in all of our cities, and the public generally supports it too. 75%, as you said. I mean, that's a big number. So 3 out of 4 New Yorkers say, "Yeah, let's do that."
To be clear, listeners, Jim's not just saying during the pandemic or for the next month during the summer. I mean, that's how you want your society to change, right?
Yeah. So back to the initial question. I mean, we ask people, how do you feel about your future? And people overwhelmingly believe that our recovery from the pandemic should not just press reset, go back to the way things were. People see this as an opportunity to build a better future for ourselves, a future that includes a healthy environment, a future that includes more sustainable choices. They don't want to just return to the past. So that's the opportunity in front of us right now. We want to share this with, we're sharing this with our partners, we're sharing this with policymakers, decision makers, so that they know. I mean, there's support now. If people want to take steps to build a better future, know that voters in New York are in favor of that. Evan, the one thing I want to talk about before we run out of time is to make sure I talk about the investment in nature piece. And you did touch on that. But I think, this is a climate related topic. That 92% of voters, huge, huge margin, supported in the idea of investing in natural infrastructure. That's wetlands, forests, filter strips, floodplains, to protect New Yorkers against climate-related disasters like severe flooding, storms, fires, and we're seeing so much more of these right now across the country. But nature provides an answer for us. If we have healthy floodplains that can absorb water during those storm events, if we have dune systems that can be a buffer against coastal events, healthy forests can soak up carbon dioxide and pump oxygen back into the air, cool our climate, cool our streets. I mean, there's an overwhelming level of support for this in New York. And we, you know, that to me is really heartening, because we know that there are answers here, that nature, if we can harness nature better, we can have a healthier climate and we can retain jobs too as we do it. And that's the last piece here too, is that just like during the FDR administration, they had, FDR had the NRA and the CCC. Those were workforces designed to create jobs for people to help emerge from the depression. And I'm not saying that the pandemic is a depression. I'm not equating that at all. But we have had job losses, and 90% of the people that we polled said improving the environment could be a key element in reversing job losses brought on by the pandemic. And 85% supported the idea that we could create jobs for young people in these fields, reducing pollution, protecting land and water, and mitigating climate change. And then renewable energy jobs, too, are another way to not only recover from the pandemic, but also build that healthier future that people want.
So what you're talking about, especially in the investing in nature and jobs section, are policies that do come with an upfront cost. I understand that the idea is long-term gain, but there's an upfront cost. Does that mean you look mostly to the federal level? Do you look to the state level, which right now Governor Cuomo says, understandably so, municipalities, state governments are hurting with finite budgets and a real loss of revenue in the pandemic. But I guess now, but into the future, Jim, are you looking at the state of the federal government for these kind of investments?
I think both, as well as local communities, too. I mean, we know that we're gonna have to put more resources, public resources, to build that healthy future. We're already seeing that in Washington right now. We've had, what, three or four COVID relief acts. There's another one being negotiated right now as we speak. And I think that the governor, too. I mean, we have lots of resources that we can deploy at the state level to help build this future. And I think Governor Cuomo has shown that he's willing to invest in these types of in the environment and natural solutions. And climate's a priority for our governor, too. We know that.
Andy writes to us to say, I've always enjoyed hiking and camping, et cetera, but with the pandemic, I've never spent more time in my kayak. I've gotten more into bird watching, particularly in my own backyard. We've used Monroe County and New York State parks more often and explored locally. Nature brings serenity. And Evan, I hope things remain changed. I work 4 days a week in the office rather than five, reducing my gas consumption. I've signed up for a CSA to ensure access to fresh local produce. This pandemic is our chance to examine the choices we make and then make meaningful change. You want to add to that, Jim? I mean, I think that kind of sums up what you heard from a lot of people.
I don't think I need to add anything to that. That was so beautifully written. That was perfect. And I think our findings are confirming what your writer said, definitely, what your listener just told you. We're seeing that a lot of people would agree with that sentiment right now in New York.
Tom is asking a question a little farther afield. He says, anything we should know about population growth and conservation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real issue. Let's be honest. One that does not get talked about enough. I think that one of the drivers of environmental change is consumption, and one of the drivers of consumption is population growth. We are seeing the more developed countries in the Western Hemisphere in particular are experiencing growth rates that are more manageable now, but we are seeing some growth rates in the developing world that still give a lot of people pause. One of the things that the Nature Conservancy and other organizations have found is that a way to deal with population growth is the education of women and girls. That has the most success at family planning type issues. So we actually are. The Nature Conservancy has invested in some what we call population health environment projects, PHE projects, and we are beginning to see that we can build a more sustainable planet if we think about population growth and providing adequate health care for people. And we're doing a really fantastic project that I've actually had the good chance to visit in Tanzania on Lake Tanganyika, where we're melding those three goals together. So I agree with your listener. These are complicated issues, but there are solutions out there. And there are people that are actually making progress at dealing with population and melding it to environmental degradation. So good question.
45 seconds, Jim. Your survey finds that despite pandemic fatigue, people are not so fatigued that they don't want permanent change. They want to change the way they live. They want to change the course that we are on as a planet. They want more action and more protection of the environment in various ways. So give me what the next year might look like, because we may still be in a pandemic next summer. What's reachable in the near future to start putting us on the course that people say they want, Jim?
Well, I think in New York, we're already, the trajectory is a good one for us. I think we are headed in the right direction. I would love to see, as I mentioned, we're sharing this information with partners and policymakers. I would love to see us, as we begin to enter into recovery phase from COVID, I would love to see us start investing more in healthy lands, healthy waters, more access for nature, and efforts to be more sustainable on a climate front too. I think you're going to see that, and stay tuned, Evan. We'd be happy to continue the dialogue with you too on these topics.
I always appreciate it. I sometimes feel like we abuse your cell phone, but I'm going to try not to, Jim. But listen.
Anytime, please.
Thanks for the time here, and we appreciate the context, and let's do talk again soon.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks again. Really appreciate your help.
You got it. Jim Howe is the chapter director of the Nature Conservancy of Central and Western New York. Fascinating stuff in that survey. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful afternoon. Hope you can get outside. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.